So welcome everybody to our very first 2018 Life Insurance Insight session. So this session we'll talk about go through pricing actuaries, whether from a technical sense or how we integrate with other teams in the companies, and also from not just from a direct insurer but also from a reinsurance perspective. So good to see a very diverse age group of actuaries here. We were more hoping to target young actuaries here. So for the more experienced actuary, please come up with really difficult questions for our talented panels towards the end of the sessions. How's that? So questions. Okay, in case of emergency, we will follow any instruction from our lovely staff member in the institute. So I think that's pretty much all my housekeeping. So I would like to introduce you to our panel of speakers. So we have speakers that are coming from individual pricing, group pricing, as well as reinsurance. So so start off with Damien. Damien will walk us through from a group insurance perspective. He has over 20 years experience in the industries, over several direct life insurance. Now, more recently, he is the principal of Allgrim Group. Yep, consulting. And then we have Andrew Parker from BT Financial Group. He's the life insurance pricing senior manager. So he will take us through the individual pricing perspective and somewhat more technical side of the actuarial's work. And then we have Adrian from Swiss Re. And before becoming an actuary, he was a physio therapist and worked in different claims team and rehabilitation team in the life insurance and CTP as well. And then he had joined the, you know, the dark side with all the actuary works we are doing now. And he's now the head of group pricing in Swiss Re, and he will talk us through from a reinsurer perspective. So I think without further ado, can I ask everyone to give a big round of applause for our speakers?
Okay, good afternoon everyone, and I'd just like to say thanks to all of you for attending these sessions. You make it the success that it is, so thank you for giving your time to attend our session today as well. I also wanted to say thanks Ricky for being such an excellent facilitator, and Ricky's really done a great job of getting the three of us together and helping us to organise our speeches and the day as well, so thank you. So I'm going to talk to you today about three things that I'd like to talk to you about. Firstly, I'd like to give you a sense of what it feels like to work in the group pricing space. And I'm going to talk about a typical week in the life of a group pricing actuary. Secondly, I'm going to talk about some important aspects of the group pricing discipline and perhaps what makes group pricing a little bit different to some of the other pricing disciplines within life insurance. And thirdly, I'll talk a little bit about some career tips and culture, and ways that I think, if so, I can give you some tips on how I think you can make your career as effective as possible. So over the next two slides, I hope to give you a flavour for the typical activities in the week of a group pricing actuary. So typically, you might spend part of your week preparing reports and analysis. You could be liaising with the appointed actuary or her representatives about aspects of the work that you're performing. And you'll probably be presenting to senior delegated authority holders within the Life Co to obtain approvals. And also with this picture here, it's important to note that people will be clapping at your presentations because they'll be so good. And then typically also, continuing the theme of the week in the life, you'll probably spend time, one real feature about group pricing which is a challenge is the products can be quite different between each of the large clients. Each of the products has a policy document which is probably tailored to that client. So one of the challenges in the group pricing space is to try and get your head around what that particular product feature means and how it might affect the claims experience of that particular scheme. So part of your week could be interacting and researching with other disciplines within the Life Co, such as product and claims functions, to understand and the features of the insurance product. And you'll also be working together with account managers and business development people to prepare presentations for the client, and perhaps sometimes even going and presenting to clients as well and trying to explain to them, enlighten them about their claims experience. So also with the photo here, you'll be having that much fun and more, obviously, because you'll be working in group pricing. So what have you noticed with all these aspects about working in group pricing? Well, my way of thinking about it is it's really about working with, and it's about communication, and I view a lot of it as go widely throughout the life company. And so my view is that group pricing is a middle to front office role, and you're responsible for strongly supporting the business development team. And it's really about being in the group pricing team is playing a key role in terms of being part of the life company's relationship with the client. So within the next two slides, I'll be talking about some of the important aspects and differentiators about group pricing. So one of the challenges of group pricing is always data. Hopefully you get lots of it and it's good, but unfortunately it doesn't always go that way. So you really need to be careful around the data that you use and try and take time to understand it. Also important is interpreting trends and changes in claims experience and trying to explain what the things are that are really driving the scheme's claims experience. And the way that we measure claims, measuring claims costs is a vitally important part of the group pricing challenge, because that's going to form, the claims cost estimate is going to form, let's face it, 85% of the price that the client is going to pay you. So measuring claims cost is a challenge. There's many different rating factors, and they're not always properly captured or analysed. And I haven't got time to go into the depth on the credibility theory, but there are many different ways to do credibility theory. It's good to have a basic understanding of some of the choices that are available to you and why you might use different ones. So I've shown one example there. That's my personal favourite, but I haven't got time to delve into why that's my favourite. But as I say, like, this is one that's typically called something like limited fluctuation. There's another one which is Bayesian, and they give slightly different ways of doing it. So it's good to try and understand a bit about the background around that. So what is the role of the group pricing actuary? I'd like to advance the hypothesis that the role of the pricing actuary is to maximise marginal profits. And I'd like to refer you to a paper which was written by an actuary called Ian Robinson in 2007. It was titled Pricing Wealth Products in Competitive Markets. I've included it as a reference at the end of my presentation. But I would highly recommend that all pricing actuaries would read this paper, as it provides important thought leadership in terms of how we should tackle challenges around fixed expenses, marginal expenses, overheads and direct expenses. Just also, the role of the group pricing actuary is definitely also being a frontline life company risk management role. And it's also trying to ensure sustainable underwriting results. So you're trying to play a role also as an owner of the business. And within reason, I think you need to try and find a way to help the life company to write the business, as I say, within reason, because if you don't win the business, you don't get the chance to make a profit. So just some brief comments on Professional Standard 200. I've highlighted some points in here that I thought were quite relevant to group pricing. So 6.3.1, for example, says you must consider all policy terms and conditions. And an example of this might be, how would you try and tackle preparing a draft pricing report if your life company is quoting on a new group arrangement, which has a TPD definition that your company has not previously managed? That's just an example of one of the challenges that you might have to come across, and you'd have to think about how you are going to discharge your professional responsibilities in terms of PS 200. So that brings me to my final point about some career tips and being successful in group pricing. So really, the heart of what we do as actuaries is working as part of a life company, but the heart of the life company is the service that we perform to our claimants and the responsibility that we have to them to get things right. And so I would suggest to you that you want to make it your business to get to know someone in the claims department. It could be the GM of claims, or it could be a head of or a seniors, but take the time to try and go and have a coffee with someone that you can reach out to in the claims department. and ask them what they do with their day. How do they do it? What are the main challenges of their role? What are the processes that underpin claims assessment? So with this photo here, that's obviously working with and getting familiar with the claims function as well. Secondly, communication. So I would encourage people to always try to summarise information as clearly and concisely as you can. Excuse me. Always try and ask yourself, what are the three key messages that are coming out in any particular project that you're working on? So how many pages do you think that a busy executive is willing to read? And given that this person might be reading your report at sort of 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, I would suggest to you that once it goes beyond 2 pages, they're probably not really much interested in reading it. So if you can't summarise it in 3 key messages and 2 pages, then you're probably not communicating that well. So that brings me to the end of my presentation. And also I've shown the reference for the paper that I referred to as well. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Damien. Sorry, I haven't put any jokes through mine, so you have to bear with me for that. So Damien talked about, and I certainly agree, that the pricing actuary sits across the entire business. Yeah, and they're sort of responsible for the profitability and the returns of the company, the products that they're looking after. So I've put together a bit of an example to work through from start to finish so we can sort of draw out how we might be using those sort of problem solving and judgment aspects and how the communication plays into that. So I'm looking at an example here where you're a life insurance company and you're introducing a new product and going through the steps that you actually have to go through for setting the price for that product. It's my contents page, that's what that is. Great. So there are important initial steps before you can actually get to the pricing of the product. So we think of the pricing function, it's the setting of the premium rates. Oh, I just adjusted my watch there, sorry. But it's about more than that, and it's about the areas where pricing can actually add value. So the first step is to understand the product. So again, this is about communicating to the product team. So not just what are the benefits, but what are the specific features that come along with that product. So not just death, TPD, trauma, but how do the different benefits link together? Are they riders? Is there some combination? What kind of occupation definitions are going to be offered? ADLs, homemakers, how do those interact with the product? What sort of opt-in and opt-out is offered on the product whenever there's an option? Because this will affect the sort of selection impact that our customers are doing. It'll affect the customer behaviour, and that'll affect the sort of things that are impacting when we get to the profit setting and the claims that we're paying out on this product. You'll also have to think through what kind of underwriting approach the product has. So if it's a direct product, is it with a PEC? Is it with light underwriting? Is it a fully underwritten product? Because this will affect the sort of customers you get in. It'll affect the engagement style. It'll affect what sort of experience they have through the products going forward, the lapse experience and claims, obviously. And the available pricing factors. So this is, we think of pricing as something that sits within just pricing, but actually, we have to work with the product teams to work out what sort of levers we have to pull to be able to adjust pricing. So smoke is an easy, obvious example. If we didn't have that as a factor, we wouldn't be thinking about our smokers more or less risk, but we'd still have to be aware of that as something that drives behaviour. So for some group schemes, some or all maybe, smoking's not a factor. So that's not a lever they have to pull, whereas individual, we tend to have that. Is occupation a factor? There's a good amount of evidence that occupation affects mortality rates, but it's not generally a factor in pricing for death products. So that's something as a pricing actuary we need to be aware where we have that control. Next one there is the marketing approach and the customer. So again, this is about talking to the people who design the product team or the business itself. What is the product for? What need does it meet? Who is the intended customer, and how do we plan to reach that customer? If it's a direct product, maybe it's just through an online channel, maybe we're making cold calls to the customer, maybe it's a little box at the end of the supermarket aisle. These all affect the sorts of customers that come to our product and try and buy our product,
And we need to make sure that the product is aligned to the right customer and the right sales channel for that customer. And as pricing actuaries, be aware of how that affects our pricing decisions. And obviously, through all of this, the understanding of the product and the understanding of the marketing approach, we're not just there to absorb information to go away and use it. We're there as a business advice channel. So we can apply our judgment and say, I think the way you've designed the marketing approach doesn't match with the customer need, or the customer need doesn't match the product, or there's an option you've put in there that we don't think is actually going to work the way you think it does when we send it to a customer. Maybe some customers are going to exploit it and make it unprofitable for anyone to buy this product. So those sort of insights can help change the direction of where the product is going before you actually get to the pricing side of the equation. And finally, the actual pricing strategy and the business's strategy. So different companies have different target returns and target metrics as well. So some companies might be interested in maximizing their EV, AV. Some might be interested in a revenue style approach. Maybe your company looks at return on capital. And they're all sensible measures that the actuary needs to be aware of in pricing. But there will be one that the company specifically needs and specifically makes its decisions based on. So you need to be aware of that. Beyond that, what is the direction of the company and the broad sales strategy? Is this product going to be the flagship for the company? So it will need to be on a fully expensed basis because this is what is driving the company's results going forward. Is it a little tiny little thing on the side to generate, I don't know, some messaging into the market, or maybe it's a lead-in channel for other products? So how it connects to the rest of the business's strategy is going to be important. What sort of level of cross-subsidies the company's willing to accept as well? So obviously it's insurance, it's risk pooling. Sometimes the pooling's not perfect and you've got some people paying too little and some too much. There are unknown cross-subsidies within areas where we can't actually work out who's paying too much and too little. And sometimes there are known cross-subsidies. Maybe competitive position or something like that is causing us to price in such a way where we know that some areas are actually getting quite a good deal and others less so. So what's the company's opinion to that? And right down the bottom, the actual target profitability. If IRR is our interested metric, what percentage are we aiming for? What do we need? And obviously that'll be different to our competitors and will affect things. Moving on. So we need to understand the actual market environment itself. So who will the product compete with, or what will the product compete with? So if it's in a retail space, it's competing with the other retail players, but maybe more targeted than that. Maybe we're only interested in a segment of the retail market. And which insurers will be, or products will be competing with in that area. And obviously the advisor interaction is a big part of that too. Maybe if you're entering a new market, maybe you have no competitors. And as a pricing actuary, this is a sort of double-edged sword there. On the one hand, you've got the ability to basically create your own market. On the other, maybe you're an early adopter and people are going to follow. And there's also that sort of regulatory side of, we don't really want to be gouging the customer. We still actually want to put together something that's of value and sensible and competitive, even if there's no one else there. How will the products compete is up there too. So are we a price player? Are we a product player? Do we have a big product that we think customers are willing to pay for? And it comes back to that understanding what the point of the product is and who our customer is. And right down the bottom, make an initial rates guess. So here's a good spot to say, if we have a target competitive position, what is our first guess of what a price that we think fits the style of product? What's a guess of what it might be? We could grab a competitor and just use their rate, or maybe pick the median or whatever, and we'll need that when we get to actual profit testing. Okay, we need to build a profit testing model, and the first thing to consider is, what is the level of complexity that we require? So this will be affected by what the complexity of the product is. If it's got a lot of options or features or benefits, you'll need to put more effort into building a more complex model. If it's not, maybe not. So customer behavior and selection is a big one to think about. And also, what are the business requirements? If the business isn't too fussed about getting too precise, if they're not too fussed about cross-subsidies, maybe a higher level model is sensible. So once you've decided what sort of model you're after, what are the required outputs? So we know, obviously, the business metrics that we need to make our decision on, or decision metrics as well as business metrics. So your EV, AV, IRRs, profit margins and revenues. But what sort of granularity do we need with that? Do we care about as an output the fact that this segment of customers' profitability is one thing or another? And similarly, it's worth considering customer value measures in there as well. So they may not necessarily be what we think from a sort of finance or profit perspective, but is the product decent value for customers? What's the loss ratio for overall customers? What's the loss ratio by segment? Are there customers who are seriously winning and seriously losing? We should be aware of that. I've listed up there a bunch of different assumptions that we need to think through one by one. I won't go through each of them, but just to point out, I guess claims is a big assumption and I've only written it once. So you need to think just the high level things, mortality, morbidity, incidents and terminations, but also impacts of selection, how different features will affect the claims, how selection will affect the claims and the different segments of those customers. And new business, obviously, I've got sales up there, but that's so it's the model points that you're putting into your black box, your profit model of some kind, be it Excel or Profit or whatever else you use. And the number of model points will reflect, again, the level of complexity that we're after. Do we care about 100,000 model points that capture every possible segment? Do we just want 20 and get a quick answer? That's all wrapped up in that understanding what the output is going to be for. Expenses is a very important one, particularly for a new product, second from the bottom there. And this will go back to our strategy again. But expenses are very volume dependent. So there's sort of a circular approach of you set the price, that'll determine how much you sell to an extent, and that'll determine the expense, which will feed back into the price that you're able to actually support, given the sorts of things you're targeting. What actual assumptions do we use? So as a pricing function, we have a slightly different role to play, or quite a different role to play than, say, a valuation actuary. And so our assumptions can be different, and it's sensible to be different. The point of a pricing assumption is to help us to make a sensible business decision. Yep, so from a valuation perspective, maybe you think the assumption is such and such for claims. From a pricing perspective, A, would need to be more granular, and B, we need to be considering maybe changes to that assumption depending on customer behavior. Maybe our claims assumption that we've got going in our existing business is one thing, but this is a new product. We can't just go and take that assumption. Maybe our expenses is one assumption, but we need to consider actually how much should this product support. So there are legitimate reasons why our pricing basis of assumptions will differ from other bases. In particular, capital is another important one where we'll differ. The business calculates its actual capital, but you can't just take that calculation and put it into a pricing model and get a sensible result. You have to think what the impact on your capital is of that product. And so that's where the company's economic capital modelling will come into play, and some kind of pricing modelling, pricing capital basis will come into play there. And finally, we get the outputs. So we've built our model, we've thought about competitive position, we've plugged our prices and our model points in, and we can actually test those rates, the initial rates. So we said we wanted to be median market, as an example. What does that actually do? Does that meet our profitability hurdles? Does that meet our segment targeting hurdles or requirements or targets? And then there's a sort of iterative process of that. This is a very short and final slide. And I know this is actually the output that many people think of when they think price setting, but I guess it's all those steps that go into before you get here that are the important parts. This is just sort of actually using the model and turning the crank and getting the outputs. So we need to test the sensitivity to the unknowns. So customer behavior is one we've talked about, or just sales volume is an important one. Basically, what happens if our guesses don't turn out to be right? Which guesses are more important? And ongoing communication. It's the last dot point there, but I did put just below it, not just actually at the end. So we talked through the many different stakeholders, claims, underwriting, product, the business owners. They're all stakeholders in this, appointed actuary evaluation teams, and we need to be communicating with them throughout the process, not just waiting to the end and coming to them with a folder of what the new price is. And that way we'll get a better outcome. So thanks for that. I'll just hand over to Adrian now.
So I'm going to talk about reinsurance pricing today. I did want to say I want to thank all the senior reinsurance pricing actuaries that are here from not from CIS Re. It's good to see you. You got the joke. So I'm going to briefly just talk about the what, why and the who of reinsurance. If you've studied 2A or gone to university, you should know this. But reinsurance is really simply the insurance for insurers. Reinsurance can take many forms, so proportional, non-proportional, excess of loss, catastrophe. Why do people choose to reinsure? Well, they want to control their volatility. They might want some capital for their business because they can't hold all the business themselves. They might be looking for some expertise around underwriting, claims, pricing, or product. And so, you know, they're the kind of things why people might use reinsurance. And I think one point to make is when we think about reinsurance, so if Swiss Re was going to go do a deal in Cambodia, it might look a lot different to doing a deal in Australia. So we have to think about, in a mature market, what can Swiss Re do or what can a reinsurer do? And in an emerging market, what sort of expertise they can provide? So I think that's something that's worthwhile thinking about, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So who are the reinsurers? Well, there's 7 local reinsurers there showing some results from the APRA stats from 2016 and 2015. 2017 is coming out probably the next couple of months. CIS Re is doing all right. this is readily available information if you want to find out about that. Pack Life, couple of zeros. Seems very convenient. I joke, but I think it's sort of important to know who your reinsurers are, what they do, what their values are, and what they sort of stand for. So thinking about risk pricing in a mature market, we think about assumptions, cash flows, how to do business in the same way that you guys would think if you're not a reinsurer. So we still have to come up with the same risk pricing as you, or we would hope to. So in a mature market, we would hope that the risk pricing would be roughly the same. And the reinsurer may have more expertise in something, but they might not. They might just have as much as you in a mature market. Where we end up with pricing and why reinsurance can offer what they do is there might be different capital requirements for the reinsurer. The cost of capital could be different. They could have different funding arrangements. So that's where the difference would lie in what a reinsurer can offer versus an insurer. Obviously, there'd be different expenses. Like I said, in an emerging market, we would hopefully be able to provide a lot more expertise. In an emerging market, you might have to price something with no data, no experience, and no one's ever done that before, and no infrastructure to make it happen. So I thought I'd just give an illustration, and this, by all means, is just an illustration. It's not anything real. But just to sort of have a look at what reinsurance could potentially do. So if an insurer took the full risk themselves, they might end up with a cash flow as such, where they might get a low return of, say, 11%. So if you want to look at the detail, feel free to get the slides, but they might end up with a cash flow like that, which shows where all their ins and outs of the cost of doing that business. So possibly with a reinsurer, you might find that the reinsurer can provide them some assistance so they don't have such a large expense. So they might be helping them out with underwriting, so the expense on that block of business isn't as high. They might be helping out with claims. They might be helping out with something else. So they might, with a reinsurer, the expenses might be lower. You're obviously paying a reinsurance commission to the insurer, so the money that they're getting is a little bit higher than just the premium. So in that case, for that book of business, they might be getting 53.5 premium for half the risk as opposed to 100 for whole of the risk. And then the cost of capital, whether that's the size of capital or the actual cost or any other benefit that reinsurer might be able to derive from global scale, might be a little bit less. And then you see that both the insurer and the reinsurer in this example are actually better off than the insurer taking it by themselves. So, you know, it might not work out exactly that way. There might not be those benefits, but it's just an idea of how reinsurance could help. So I've sort of talked around this. So insurer gets increased premium contribution from commission, potentially less expenses. The reinsurer might have a lower capital cost than the insurer, diversification benefits, retro structures, potentially able to access capital at a lower cost, and should be able to have lower expenses due to global scale. So using the same example, if you've got to the same return, we're talking about a 1.4% reduction. So if someone's in a highly competitive tender for business in group per se, potentially your choice of reinsurer and what your reinsurer could do for you could tip you over the scale. I wanted to give a couple of examples of reinsurance deals. So these reinsurance deals, the information is publicly available in the market. It has they don't have anything to do with Swiss Re, but I'll pick the two ones that were talked about in the news at the end of last year. So the first one was AMP. So they recently did a new deal with Gen Re where they released $500 million in capital from AMP Life because of Gen Re taking over part of the book of their business. That was an extension to their already reinsurance that they had with Munich Re. And so AMP are now were able to release that capital, use that capital for something else to grow their business. So the resulting of the reinsurance on that was allow AMP that had 65% of their retail life insurance portfolio reinsured from claims after 1 November. So that's obviously quite a big deal for AMP to do that deal. It gives them that opportunity to release that capital. I can't talk for AMP or the reasons or their strategy behind it, but as you can see, that reinsurance in that case was able to help AMP divest some of their business and the capital intensiveness of it, which is often talked about in the market. We don't have too many banks left that are carrying a life insurer these days. The other one that was recently in the market was the Zurich acquisition of OnePath Life. And the sale was for $2.85 billion. And $1 billion of that was upfront reinsurance commission. So from in terms of a pricing perspective, the reinsurer in that case needs to get a return on their $1 billion of upfront reinsurance commission for the life of the policies of OnePath. And so that enables Zurich to be able to do this deal and only have to raise $1.85 million. Obviously, their return or their longer return of their cash flows, part of that's going to the reinsurer, but it gives you an idea of what the kind of things happen in the reinsurance market and the kind of deals that happen and the scale. So following that deal, Zurich will be Australia's largest retail life insurer as measured by in-force premiums with more than 1.5 million customers. So you can see just in the market, again, I can't talk to the specifics of the deal, but you can see just in the market how reinsurance can move very large amounts of capital and really get involved in shaping the market itself. Thank you.
Thank you to our speakers. So now it's the time for questions. So if you have any question, please raise your hand. I think Lisa or Sarah will hand you a microphone so that we can get it on recording for webinar. So to kickstart, we got one question from webinar. The question is direct to you, Damien. So you talked about marginal profits and maximize marginal profit. The question was, so who pays the fixed cost? And they also have a follow-up question saying that what is the risk of adopting such approach?
Okay. Yep. You might. To your right. So, look, that's a good question. I'm going to be a little bit rude, and I'm going to suggest that you read the Ian Robinson paper, because it gives a very thorough treatment of those exact issues. But there are a lot of well-worked examples of that paper about why it makes more reason to maximise marginal profits rather than thinking about covering some notion of fixed expenses. And I think also I'd sort of think about the comments that Andrew made in his speech as well, that expenses starts to become a bit cyclical when you start to think about the interaction between the price that you charge and the volume that you'd sell. Thanks.
Great. Any question from the crowd? Any more question from the webinar? Great.
It was interesting having one group, one retail, and then a reinsurer. Neither of the group or individual guys talked about how you take account of reinsurance in your pricing and what's the best and appropriate way to do it. Is reinsurance seen as a risk management tool or as a way to leverage up your profitability? So how would you appropriately account for reinsurance in your pricing approaches?
So to jump in before the speaker, that was our ideas of gathering the speakers, not the way they designed the content, but yeah, take it away.
Sure, I'll jump in then. It depends, I guess, is the short answer. Different companies will use reinsurance for different reasons, and as a pricing actuary, obviously, with only 10-15 minutes each, we can't go through every possible consideration, but you would need to consider that. So what does the particular reinsurance agreement that you have or are negotiating do to your price setting or your pricing decisions? It will reduce your exposure to some contracts. It will change the structure of your cash flows with pushing out of the cost potentially with a reinsurance commission. Maybe there's a management reason of why we have a certain risk appetite. So they're all very specific considerations to the specific question. It's not something you can ignore, definitely.
Great. Any more other questions? Okay, I got a couple of questions just while all these brains are working and find out how to position the really difficult question for our speakers. Okay, so maybe let's circle back to Adrian. So would you like to share with us what's the difference as an actuary working in a direct insurer and a reinsurance company?
Sure, thanks for the question, Ricky. I've worked in both and I've also worked in a company that does both, but I think there's certain advantages working for an insurer, because you tend to see like the whole end-to-end process. So especially thinking about individual business, you're getting more in depth into the sales and the structures and what you're trying to actually achieve, who your target market is, those kind of queries, not just thinking about risk for a particular cohort. And that can be very interesting, because you're actually getting into that detail, you're covering that whole, I guess, life cycle of a policy. Sometimes with reinsurance, you might not necessarily have that detailed view or as detailed, and you're certainly not involved in the strategy setting of what the insurer is trying to do. You might provide advice on that, but you're certainly not setting that strategy. When you're working for a reinsurer, you get to see the global scale. You get to talk to people all over the world with different expertise, and when you're working as a reinsurer, you can see how all the different life companies operate, how they think about things. And in a way, you get to help shape the market by sort of, you know, being able to provide some level of expertise across the market, I guess, in risk setting. So that's sort of an exciting thing about reinsurance.
Great. That sounds like working for a reinsurer is very similar to working for consulting firms. I'm not sure about the long hours, but yeah. Any more questions from the crowd? Okay, so my background is... Oh, one. Great. Sorry. Yep.
Thank you for the panel's presentation. I have two questions. The first one is, what's the difference between group pricing and individual pricing? The second one is I was thinking, just one presenter said, there could be difference between the price assumption and the valuation assumption. So I was wondering how to justify the inconsistency between profitability in pricing and just in other words, from pricing's perspective, the product is profitable and the VNB is acceptable. And from valuation's perspective, we use best estimate assumption to calculate the VNB, and it shows probably the VNB is negative. So how to justify the inconsistency?
Thank you. So it's about two bases of assumptions and also the difference in individual and group. So.
Okay, so the differences between individual and group definitely relating to the question of financing. Within the retail market, you've got the financing of the initial commission and heavy upfront costs associated with underwriting the risk. And whereas the group market is, there's typically no financing. There probably is, if you think about all the intensity that goes into a new business tender, but life insurance companies don't tend to look at it as an upfront investment of money in the way that they would for pricing of retail business. So it's definitely around the financing, and it's around the fact that, you know, if you look at the dynamics of the group product, you're going to see that expected claims cost is around 80 to 90% of the premium income, whereas for retail that might be, I don't know, Andrew would know much better than me, but it might be 50%. So the extra margins associated with recovering those initial financing costs make it a very different kind of pricing exercise.
Thanks. I'm pretty sure the retail loss ratio has climbing over the years, but Andrew, take away about assumptions or the group and individual?
Yeah, sure. I'll just jump straight into the second question. It's a very good question, and it's part of the difficult aspect of deciding what a sensible pricing assumption is. If you've made a sensible assumption, you shouldn't, in 2 years' time, find that it varies so wildly from a valuation assumption that a piece of business you thought was profitable isn't. When you're setting a pricing assumption, it's more about the marginal assumption, or the right pricing assumption should help you make the right pricing decision. And to do that, the assumption should reflect what the marginal impact of that business you're looking at, or if it's existing business, the marginal impact of the change you're exploring would have on that portfolio. If you've set a pricing assumption and experience has varied from your original guesses, then yeah, you'll have a difference in profitability once you get to the valuation stage. I've seen that with volume and expense assumptions in particular for new businesses. But if the experience goes as you expect it, you shouldn't have a position where it looked profitable to begin with and it's not afterwards, if you've done it right.
Thank you.
I might start with adding a bit for that last one, and then questions for you both. A couple of the other differences between group and individual has a lot to do with premium rate guarantees. It's quite common in group to guarantee a premium rate for a set period of time. Your pricing in group can be based on the self-experience of that group's past performance rather than an overall portfolio. And if the customer decides to go somewhere else, you don't have it until natural expiry like you do with individual business. And that applies on the reinsurance side of things as well. I'd be keen to hear from both the retail and group guy circumstances where you've looked at a benefit design and said that's not a sustainable benefit design that can't be priced and had to say no, and how you get that through the company. Because sales want this really great improvement and it's just the next thing that's going to make it such a sellable product.
Good question. I'll be the retail guy, Andrew. When I was talking through those steps of understanding the product, that's the sort of thing that you would hope would come out early, because nipping an idea in the bud is much easier than 12 months into a 13-month project. I'll add a little bit then. When I was talking about setting an initial price and getting an initial estimate of profitability, that's a really good way to pull out those sort of things. If maybe it's something you don't have experience with, so the judgment isn't automatically there that this particular feature is unprofitable or unworkable. So getting a quick go in and a quick estimate is a useful way to pull out those sorts of insights. I have seen specific examples of product features like that, and how to communicate that is really to show what the impact of that would be on the customers that are buying this product. So a product I had been looking at in the past was looking at a particular feature, and I'm being very generic, sorry, that basically would have caused the premium to be nearly double what it actually was, and only have been taken up heavily selectively by a couple of percent of policyholders. So just conveying that, it makes the decision quite easy. 98% of people are going to pay double what they should be for something they're not going to use or want.
And Anthony, just to answer your question on the group side, I suppose your starting point, I guess, would always be the company's risk appetite statement or similar, such as a good underwriting guideline, which should provide some sort of guidance in these situations of seeing things that you as the pricing actuary would think or feel that are high risk. Although, having said that, there are examples that will crop up from time to time where, as the pricing actuary, you will have concern about the sustainability. And I would say that, yes, there's normally sort of a committee, there's normally some sort of committee within the Life Co that is going to consider any large new business opportunities, at which committee the pricing actuary will have an opportunity to voice your concerns. And then the other ways of dealing with that might be to think about what other risk mitigants there are that the company could put in place, and within the group market that would be things like perhaps restricting the automatic acceptance limits or severely curtailing the rate guarantee potentially. And then I would suggest that once you get past those product design issues, you'd probably be into trying to put some options that you feel are more sensible or sustainable to the client as well, to just keep the try and perhaps rechannel the conversation a little bit.
I was just going to add one thing, is that obviously the rate guarantees are quite short in group. So if you're going to do something very new and novel, then you're probably not going to give it a very long guarantee.
Great. Okay, so Damien talked about the upfront efforts on going through a tender process. So I thought I would throw the question to Damien and Adrian to talk about how much work or what kind of pressure and timeline or journey that you go through a tender process from a group and a reinsurance perspective.
Okay, so the challenges of a group tender is obviously you've got some challenges around the project itself, typically to do with the timeline can be quite challenging, and also assessing and managing the data as well. That's always going to be difficult and very key to the project. But equally, it's a very exciting process as well, because it's taking place under a fairly time-constrained environment, and you're interacting every single day with people from business development, underwriting, claims, to get the right outcomes for the client. And so I've sort of have a background from within TAL, and there would be a really quite an intense environment around the new business process, and you'd have daily stand-up meetings, which is, it's quite an exciting project group to be part of. But I would say that if I could summarise it in one way, I would say the real challenge of the group tender is to develop what you think is a coherent, what I call pricing narrative, is my word. And that's really trying to understand and explain both to your appointed actuary and to the client what are the key drivers of this scheme's claims experience. To me, that's the key challenge.
It's always exciting when there's a tender on. There's always a lot of there's a good atmosphere with the team. I think the thing about group is it's, and I've seen it in a lot of the different insurers as well, that there is a real strong cohesive teamwork idea in bringing people together. Where I work, we have this thing called a cross-functional team. So it's getting everyone together, getting everyone's thoughts, getting claims, underwriting, markets, clients, and just getting everyone in the room and actually trying to deliver on something, you know, in these tight timeframes. You know, we have the added complexity of having to go all around the world to get approvals and you know, I just think it's exciting and you know, when we do have to work late, we have dinner together and we do it, you know, we make it make it fun. Like, so I mean I think on individual business stuff that I've worked on, it does take 12 to 13 months, so it can drag on. But like, I think having that short time frame and that real team environment really helps. And I think thinking about what Damien said in his presentation is important, that communication piece.
Yeah, definitely resonated with Adrian's response. I remember last time I worked on the outside of the tender, every day I just message, and I'm running late for dinner. but yeah, teamwork is definitely the case. So I personally found that throughout that project, you know who you love and you wouldn't mind helping them to review just a little more because you want the end outcome to be great. So it's a fascinating process, I have to say. So I also got a question for individual pricing. So Andrew, to your opinion, how has life insurance profit testing or modeling or the way actuaries work have transformed from, say, 10 years ago to now?
So how has retail pricing changed in 10 years? I guess some areas that are constantly changing, the pricing actuaries need to be aware of, are around medical and technological advances, which impact our claims experience, the needs customers have, the viability of products if you look at something like trauma, and availability of information. Particular thing that's been unfolding over the last decade has been the increase in media scrutiny and scrutiny in general from the regulators and customers of life insurance products. So I think it was back in 2011, ASIC were commenting on CCI and recently on funeral products and very recently on channel pricing, the value customers are getting out of insurances. So as pricing actuaries, we need to be aware of these things, and certainly the businesses are very sensitive to reputational impacts. We should be aware of that. We should have always been aware of that, to be honest. But it's certainly getting a lot of focus now. So when we're thinking about pricing, there's the customer value, there's the profitability, and there's what the reputational impact of that might be. How might it be seen? We need to be aware of that.
Great. Thanks a lot. Yep. At the back. Thanks.
I'll stand. Thank you for the panel. Question regarding to, during recent years, a lot of changes in the market, in the insurance market in particular, you know, the banks emerging their wealth management arm, life insurance, and with the entrance of a lot of overseas players in the Australian market, as well as disruptions like from, you know, big data and AI, all this technological change. I guess my question for all of you is, what's your thoughts in terms of the competitiveness of life insurance in Australia? And also, what, with all these changes, what may have an impact on how pricing actuaries work, I don't know, 5-10 years later? Thank you.
So it's all about money from across the ocean and robots rising, I guess. So, any takers? Yep.
Yeah, one thing I've been thinking about, the future for the pricing actuary and you know, even the valuation actuary, I think you have to make sure that you have diversified skills, so when things change and things become more efficient, you can still have a good job. You don't want to end up just processing or something like that. So there will be I imagine there will be pressures. You know, we've certainly talked about the idea internally, can you build a group pricing model where you just feed the data in and 5 minutes later you have a range of answers. And I think, you know, I think it's important to recognise that you have a wide variety of skills that can be offered to a company, and make sure that you develop those, and make sure that you try and do think laterally about what you do and why you do it. I think there's always a place for actuaries in businesses, but it's going to be more about how to communicate results and why things are happening, as opposed to just crunching numbers. So I think I'll leave it there and let the other guys comment on the other parts.
Yeah, well, I suppose back in the early part of the 2000s, CBA decided that it was a great idea to buy a business called Colonial First State. And then the big four Australian banks, being what they are, they always do what the other ones do. Let's just do that. So they all went and did the same thing. They decided that it was smart to buy a life company. Unfortunately, they didn't extract out of that. They didn't get the synergies that they thought they would have between getting their bank customers to buy life products. And they also found that the return on capital of a life business is much lower than they would like. So then in 2014, or whatever it was, NAB made a big decision and sold MLC, and then they all went and did the same. So,
All except one. Yep.
Basically, yeah, except for one. So basically, they decided to do that because the return on capital was not to their liking. So as per Adrian's comment, most of the Australian life cos are now going to be part of big multinationals, and I think that will mean it's clearly a change in the scale of these organisations. And also, perhaps, as Adrian mentioned as well, their functional areas in which they can perform these some of the roles could even start to happen a little bit more overseas, or there could be more pooling of resources throughout the Asia-Pac region. I suppose that would be one obvious view on where things might be going.
I think, Adrian, you showed some slides on APRA profitability stats for 2015-2016. So it looks like overall the reinsurance industry was making some profit over these years, but I guess if you go back the past 10 years, this wasn't the case. How do reinsurance pricing actuaries get comfort that the market is sustainable given the level of competition, in that there's a number of reinsurers here that aren't writing much business at all?
I think the way that we look to approach it is to make sure we have a strong market framework about the type of business we are writing, have a strong risk appetite, idea of what we want to write, and really try and understand where we think something is going to meet our return, and when we think the market is a soft market and prices are too cheap, we have to be prepared to let business go and not put ourselves in that position of what happened, for example, in group risk in 2013 and 2014. That's cold comfort sometimes, because you don't want to lose business. And so, but I think as a pricing actuary in reinsurance, you need to be smart and not just chase everybody down the rabbit hole. But, reinsurers are much like big banks. If someone else is going down there, then I'll just price it like that as well. So I think reinsurers need to make sure they have some discipline about how they consider their risk and be prepared to walk away if it's not in their appetite.
Thank you. Yep. Another question at the back.
I'm curious, with reinsurers being so international, how much consideration is given to what's going on elsewhere in the world and the books that you have, in the other legs of your business internationally in pricing of reinsurance locally?
So when the group risk crisis happened, the story at Swiss Re is that the current head of reinsurance had just told a group of analysts, after releasing a result on US mortality business that was less than favourable, that there was no other problems in our business. And then the Australian group risk crisis happened, and there was a lot of scrutiny about what are they doing in Australia. So what happened, to answer your question, is these very senior people, including the chief pricing actuary, came and basically lived in Australia for 6 months to help fix the problem. And so when something is serious going on in a business somewhere, people do take notice of it. It's quite a serious thing, and our whole framework of actually doing business has changed, and the amount of connection we have internationally is quite broader and demanding. So, I can't comment for other insurers, but I can say that in our approach, we care about everything that we're doing, and if there's if there's something that's happening in China and it's an issue, then they'll send people to China and work out, are we doing the right thing? They'll do a research piece if there's something happening somewhere else, and they'll think about actively changing the strategy as fast as they can.
Thanks. Anyone else? Yep.
Thank you. Could I ask, what do you think the impact of big data, group pricing specifically? I think, because we just mentioned data is the major challenge for group pricing.
So yeah, on top of all the unclean data, now we have big data.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk on that. The impact of big, so just the question, just to summarise it back, was what's going to be the impact of big data in group insurance? I mean, unfortunately, you're a little bit constrained about what you can do because it comes down to the quality and amount of data that the superannuation fund is capturing about your customers, oftentimes. And that can be a bit limiting because often you might only know the gender, date of birth, cover level. You may not even know whether the cover level was granted under automatic acceptance or underwritten in certain instances, or that cover amount could have been taken as an initial opt-up choice, which is a feature of many of the products. So the level of data is not at the level that we would like, I would suggest. Now, so in that sense, I would say big data could still make a lot of inroads into the group pricing market and really be a way of improving the analysis techniques that are being used.
All right, thanks.
You talked earlier about how long it takes to do a pricing exercise. When it comes to retail pricing, by the time you've actually finished off this exercise, your competitors may have changed their prices and you may not sit where you wanted to have in the market. How do you deal with that problem?
Yes, that is a big problem. Difficulty is basically it. This is part of the judgment of what you need to think about as a pricing actuary. So there's a little bit of reading the landscape and looking what competitors have done recently to try and use that to think about what other competitors might do in the future. So if 80% of our competitors had just increased prices by 20% on a particular block, we would probably expect the rest of those competitors to follow suit soon. So we would definitely have to factor that in when looking at competitive position in 12, 18 months' time. There is definitely a big lead time between deciding these things, for a retail advised business, there's a big lead time. Maybe smaller portfolios or simple portfolios can shorten that. Reinsurers are often a good place to get that kind of industry insight from too. So the reinsurers have a bunch of different retail clients or individual business clients, and they might, well, they won't be able to share X company is doing this. They'll certainly have a view of our other clients are interested in this area. Other people are exploring the sorts of things you're looking at or not looking at. So they'll have a view of where, at least of the companies they see, where that part of the market might be heading. Good question.
Any more questions from the floor? And no more questions from the webinar? Okay. If that's okay, thank you so much for your time. Can I ask you to give a big round of applause for our speakers?